Greetings, listeners. I'm Carla Golden, and I'm here with Priyanka Ramesh. This is Priyanka's first time co-hosting Top of the Noggin, but she's actually the president of Noggin, NYU's Neuroscience Outreach Group. Priyanka, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Priyanka. I am a fifth year PhD student at NYU Center for Neuroscience. And right now I work on visual development, especially attention on kids with lazy eye, which is also known as amblyopia. But yeah, and I'm also, yes, as you mentioned, the president of Noggin, and very much interested in bringing neuroscience to the community.
Awesome. So happy to have you here. And as you know, our podcast is focused on bringing you the latest and most exciting breakthroughs in neuroscience, with an emphasis on new studies, cutting-edge technology, and neuroscience and culture. Today, we're going to focus on the culture of neuroscience. We'll speak to Shade Abiodun about her article that came out last year, titled Seeing Color, A Discussion of the Implications and Applications of Race in the Field of Neuroscience. Shall we bring her in now?
Sure. Shade Abiodun graduated from Duke University with distinction in neuroscience in 2018. She researches cognitive neuroscience and is about to start her PhD in Princeton University. She's also created films that you can check out at her website, www.shade.space, which is www.sade.space. Shade, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're so happy you're here. Thank you so much for coming on. So the first question that we usually ask people is about their origin story. So what's your background in science? How did you get into it? And what has been your journey so far?
Yeah, I think for me, my background in science starts from an unfortunately early age, where I think I was like 4 or 5 playing around with my kiddie laptop and my night lamp and trying to see if I could plug the two together to like basically understand how electricity works. But if you fast forward quite a few years, when I was applying to undergrad institutions, I was actually an international student at the time. So I was based in South Africa, living there with my family. And I applied far and wide, ended up choosing Duke, and came to Duke fully with the intention of going to med school. So I came in as a pre-med. And before I had actually chosen or left home to go to college, my dad had said, Shade, I really think you should consider studying neuroscience. Like, I feel like the brain is such an interesting, you know, topic right now. There's so much research happening around it. And I had one of those moments where I was like, no, Dad, that's your dream, and wanted to study something completely different. But my freshman year, I got to campus and I was placed in this thing called a focus cluster. So Duke has this program where freshmen are able to take classes within a certain topic or realm of study. And the one I was placed in was called Exploring the Mind, and it focused on neuroscience. And I think right from the bat, the classes I got to take, my first class was a neurobiology course, which was definitely extremely immersive, super informative, intimidating, but so intriguing to me. And I think that was my most formative introduction to what neuroscience was, and I very quickly and reluctantly started falling in love with it. And it was from that class that I was able to find out and secure my first research position as an RA in a neurobio lab. I was in the neurobiology department doing research on optogenetics and looking at olfactory systems in mice. And it was, again, a very hands-on experience, very intimidating for little old freshman me, but so intriguing at the same time. I just knew that there was something about research that really pulled me in. And so I spent probably a year in that lab and then just continued charting my way through the research community at Duke. I got to spend a semester in a abnormal psychology lab. I was doing a research practicum there. And that was really interesting to me as well, and introduced me to the human side, or the human side of research. I then hopped over to a TMS lab. I was in one of my neuroscience classes and heard about this method called transcranial magnetic stimulation. And it sounded so futuristic to me and so intriguing that I said, oh, I wanna study that. I wanna do research on that. So I reached out to a professor who I knew had just gotten a grant and said, hi, I'd love to work for you. I'd love to learn this technique. And she took me in, and I not only was an RA in that lab, but ended up actually getting to do an independent study in her lab with her as well. And it just kind of went from there, continued in different labs, doing different types of research. I feel that I sometimes wonder if it's an advantage or a disadvantage that I got to do so much lab hopping in my time as an undergrad, because of course I think there's one territory or there's one route that I could have taken of being in one lab for all 4 years of undergrad and really deepening my understanding of a specific method and topic. But I really do love that I got to hop around because it exposed me to so many different techniques, so many different approaches within neuroscience, animal research and human research, that I think it was the formative experience that I needed to then realize that I wanted to hop into research in a kind of a longer term way. And I wanted to do my thesis in that TMS lab, but my PI ended up moving institutions. So I settled into a lab in the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, otherwise known as the CCN at Duke, that was focusing on attention and memory research, and it was an EEG lab. And I did my thesis in that lab and really got, again, what was a very hands-on, very formative technical experience, and learning in a short period of time, not only how to understand the theory behind a method, but also implement that technique. I think after I completed my thesis research and graduated, I ended up staying at Duke. I left out a very important part of the story. I was pre-med, and I think it was my senior year. I'd known that whole time while I was doing research and taking different classes that I was still very much on the fence about pursuing a career in medicine versus pursuing a career in something else. And I think what really pulled me towards the research side of things was realizing that what initially got me interested in science was getting to ask questions that I was curious about and exploring those answers. And I think in terms of exploring a medical career, I felt like I would be somewhat limited in that regard and in that sphere of getting to explore that. And so my senior spring, I was sitting in a biochemistry class and I finally said, you know what? I don't know if I want to be pre-med anymore. And walked out of that class and luckily was still doing my thesis research and everything. So I had an idea of what it could look like to still do science without focusing on kind of the medical side of things. So I graduated, I took up a post-bac position, an RA position in a lab in the CCN as well, where I got to do decision-making and aging research. And that was really informative as well, because I hadn't done that type of research before and hadn't been in a setting where I was doing, doing science, I guess, for lack of a better term, in a full-time capacity. It had only ever been a part-time job or a work-study position. And so that was really informative as well. I got my exposure to so many different types of literature in that lab, not only neuroeconomics and decision-making, but then eventually also social and affective neuroscience, and then what I settled on as my particular interest, naturalistic stimuli work. And I think if I hadn't been in the post-bac position that I was in, I would have never stumbled across this, you know, other sub-realm of neuroscience research that was employing films, movies, kind of visual media to understand more about cognition and social affective processing. And so it was in my second year of a post-bac at Duke that I then started applying for grad school. All the schools that I applied to, all of the labs I was applying to were focusing on kind of naturalistic stimuli use in understanding more about different elements of human cognition, whether it be perception, memory, individual differences in understanding or kind of the cognition of stimuli. And so I ended up choosing, or both being accepted to and then choosing, to go to Princeton, because Princeton was a wonderful institution, but also was sort of a hub of that type of research. It's where many of those questions started being asked. And so I'll be starting my PhD program there in the fall. I'm very excited, very nervous, because it's, you know, a whole nother chapter of life, but very excited for the work I get to do there.
It's like you've been so resourceful for throughout your whole undergrad experience. I remember getting into undergrad and then only in like end of sophomore year, someone mentioned, maybe you should work in a lab if you're interested in neuroscience. And I was like, what is a lab? Like, I just didn't even know. And so it's been, I mean, I think I lost count of your, how many labs you've worked in.
Same.
Yeah.
Comes around labs a lot. And my, like, I think it was really essential for understanding what it is that you want to do. Cause you equally, like, you need to find the things that you're passionate about, but you also need to figure out what doesn't work for you. And definitely. Going into grad school is awesome.
Yeah. And it's a huge, I think one of the just overall mottos that I have is access, equity, and just exposure. Those are all really major concepts, not only in the questions we ask within the field of neuroscience, but then even getting into neuroscience as a field itself. And so the fact that I had the opportunity to be exposed to so many different types of research questions and methods, I don't take that for granted at all. And there are times where I know that if I didn't have the flexibility to explore in the way that I did, I wouldn't be where I am today, hopefully where I am however many years down the line. And so having mentors who pushed me to, you know, explore the questions that I got to explore, or pushed me to explore new questions that they weren't yet exploring, and said, why don't you do work with this person? Why don't you look at this? Why don't you look at that? It was very instrumental in me sort of being shaped into the budding scientist that I'm hoping to be.
So our next question is basically now about your paper. So basically we kind of wanted to know what inspired you to kind of write this paper in the first place, which was published last year, and, you know, about the inclusion and representation of the marginalized identities in neuroscience.
Definitely. So I actually wrote that paper. The first iteration of that paper was written when I was in undergrad. It was my senior spring again. I was supposed to be writing my thesis and got completely distracted and decided to write the paper instead. Still did eventually write my thesis though. And I think what initially got me interested in writing that piece was this medical sociology class that I was taking. And in that class, we were exploring so many different questions, but there was a unit that we had focusing on the topic of phrenology, for instance. And phrenology was really interesting for me to explore. Of course, like a technique used way back when, not employed anymore, thank goodness. But it opened up this realm of discussion around scientific racism and kind of how different ways of looking at the brain, the mind, have been implemented and utilized to push a lot of these narratives. In that same class, we got to read A Genealogy of Modern Racism by Cornel West, which is a piece that I recommend for everyone to read. And there are so many different thinkers, scientists, scholars that he cites in that piece that just had so many important contributions to the field of science, but also these very problematic views about Black people, about people of color that were never taught to me in my introductory courses, were never taught to me in these classes I was taking and learning about them. And I think that really sparked something in me to say, well, if we're able to just take a small little morsel of this here in this conversation, I'm sure there's a much larger discussion that needs to be had about the ways in which we've been very selective in both our history of the field, the accounting that we've done of how neuroscience has come to take shape, but also where we are now and where we're going. Because I always preface, especially now that the paper has gotten a little bit more traction, I preface every conversation by saying, I'm not a race scholar. I'm not a race expert. I just so happen to be a Black woman in this field who is a scientist, or forming into a scientist in training, and these issues directly affect me. And because of that, I think they need to be talked about. And so when I wrote that piece, it was originally going to be published in a undergrad review journal that didn't end up getting picked up for that particular issue. And during my post-bac, Frontiers of Human Neuroscience put out a call for a special issue that they were writing on or publishing on representation and diversity in the neurosciences. And I said, well, I wrote a piece on this already. Unfortunately, it's currently 4,000 words, so I might have to whittle it down a little bit. But I sent it to them, and it resonated with them. And so then we went through the review process and was eventually published. And what's so interesting for me now is realizing, like, what would it have looked like if the piece was published in the undergrad review journal instead of in Frontiers? What would it have looked like in terms of people's access to it, in terms of its relevance in the current conversations? And just the way that you know, we're now having this reevaluation of neuroscience as a field.
Also, it's just very impressive that it's like a sole author paper. And you did, this is your first paper that you published in terms of in a major journal?
In a major journal, yes. I published one other paper in an undergraduate journal, but this is the first one that really went through that review process and then was disseminated to the world.
I mean,
it's very impressive.
Thank you so much.
You said in there I'm part of March for Science New York City, and we've been having these conversations recently about having anti-racist in STEM. And something that has been brought up is that people who are marginalized are feeling this, like, I don't know what the word is, but like conflict of like, you know, I really care about speaking up and, you know, trying to make changes that I see need to be met. But I also, at the same time, I'm a scientist and doing my science work. And like, how do I like vary the two? And like, do I leave science because I think that there's like such a big problem out there and I need help fight? Or, you know, like, yeah, what's your response to that? I mean, I think that you handled it in such a way, but that also, again, as you said, like it took time away from writing your thesis.
Yeah, that is so, so real. And that's something that I've thought about both within myself, but then even in the conversations that I've had with other trainees that are at my level, they're coming into grad school, people who are currently in grad school, as well as postdocs, where it's a very interesting time to be a person of color, to be a Black person, because these are issues that are always in kind of our dialogue, our experiences, our discourse, but the fact that they're now being elevated and amplified so publicly on a societal platform, like you said, it brings this conflict of, I want to be able to take this moment and talk about them to voice my experiences that I haven't been able to voice in this way before. But there's this sort of double expectation of me not only now becoming an advocate and a voice of the voiceless, but also still doing the science that I need to do, and being the academic contributor that I need to be. And I would say it's very draining. And I say that not only just from my own experience, but a lot of the conversations I've had with people, there just seems to be a perpetual exhaustion that everyone feels, not only just because 2020 is an insane year and it does feel like the world is burning in a lot of ways, but there is a lot that's riding on this moment going past just this moment. And it really taking shape into a movement. And it feels as though in order for it to be legitimate and for it to be properly actualized, it does need to be Black voices at the frontier. But the fact that there are so few already means that the voices that exist have to be loud. And so I would say I haven't quite figured out the best way to approach it or what the solution to that is. I think it's one thing I've done for myself, especially now being in this phase between my full-time position in a lab and preparing to go into a full-time position as a student, is when I've felt that I've needed rest, I've taken that rest. When I felt that I need to take a step back, I take that step back. And conversely, when I felt that I need to speak up, I need to say something, I take the opportunity to speak up and say that thing, because more than ever, people are listening.
In terms of the academia, right, so, you know, we're all part of academia, and now you're officially entering the kind of road. what kind of structural changes would you kind of want to see in academia in terms of, you know, making these issues more visible and kind of achieving a better, you know, more equal opportunistic?
Mm-hmm. Huge question. And it's one that I've mulled over a lot, not only in you asking it, but just in conversations I've had in the last few weeks and months as well, because I think what's been made obvious on every level of the current events and how things are playing out is that the change that needs to happen is monumental on a societal level, within the institution that is academia, within our kind of intrapersonally as well as interpersonally. It's just there's multiple layers at which we have to change and evolve. Within academia itself, I think one of the questions that's come up most pertinently or most prominently is this question of, well, is it about getting more scientists of color in a room? Is it about changing our faculty proportions or kind of diversity distributions in departments? Is it about creating more grants for students of color? Is it about having as many diversity initiatives as possible? And I think that on the surface is a very tempting road to take. And it's one that even I have bought into at times of saying, well, yes, the solution is to have more voices in the room. But funnily enough, I think it was last week, I saw on Twitter, I was kind of reading through a bunch of interactions that people were having, and there was a fellow alumna of Duke who is currently an astrophysicist PhD student. And she was talking about how just in her experiences within academia, she's been so worn out at times and so disillusioned that she actually no longer buys into the concept of outreach, but rather buys into the concept of inreach. So instead of trying to pull more people into the field, focusing on the people who have already opted in to kind of remaining in or being in the realm of academia and what resources can be given to them, what support they can get. And that was really interesting for me to hear because I've never thought of it that way before. And as an individual who I think many of the opportunities that I've gotten to kind of learn more about research to advance in the academic realm, I've sought out myself. It hasn't been, for the most part, through outreach programs. I think that's a very valid approach, where if you bring more people into the field, if you bring more people into the environment, but the environment itself is still toxic and the underlying issues haven't been resolved, then those people are simply going to kind of feel the ripple effects of that toxicity. They won't be able to heal it because they themselves will be suffering. And so I think that brings into question what I mentioned before, that idea of having more diverse voices and faces in the room. I think that's one part of the solution, but there's also an evaluation of how academia is structured. In what ways do we structure our incentives, structure our advancement in the field, structure our camaraderie and just the ways that we collaborate as scientists? And is that structured or currently implemented in such a way that only certain people get to succeed and others are kind of destined to burn out? And so I think that's one thing that's worth evaluating. I think also, like I was saying before, access and resources are huge. I think that many of the conversations that I've gotten to have with people about diversity, about equity, about representation in science have happened with diverse, equitable, and representative people. But there's a need to take that conversation into the mainstream, and I wouldn't say force everyone to engage per se, but make it so that the discourse is not relegated to kind of a side room or a side conversation, but sort of make it somewhat mandatory to engage in discussions of diversity, of inclusion. Because if there are people who can influence the change the most, I think it's people who aren't currently opting into having the conversations because they don't feel a need to. And so making sure that conversation is brought to them could potentially be another very influential change.
Yeah, and that I think goes to your point about having the people who are by POC having to deal with the burden of making sure that there's support and inclusion. And spreading that out and making it's a community issue that we're all working on together. Mm-hmm. When you were looking at grad schools, how much did that factor in? Were you looking at the diversity of the faculty? How upfront are they about, you know, their care that they give grad students? I think that most institutions have like diversity statements, but I've heard a lot about pushback on that, of how that can be lip service. So So yeah, what was your process when you're thinking of grad school?
That's a great question, actually. I think it was very much subconscious for me, where I knew that many of the institutions that I would be applying to, there was a very high chance that I'd be the only face in the room that looked like me and the only person coming in with some of the experiences that I've come in with. And that mindset just came from that being the past, the previous experiences that I'd had, being a neuro major at Duke, being at Duke as an institution, where you get very used to being alone in certain spheres and realms. And so I think it was less me looking at institutions and saying, what does their faculty breakdown look like? What do their departments look like? And that being sort of an end all be all of where I decided to apply. I focused a lot of my efforts and energy into, when I was going for interviews, what did it feel like being there? And I think one thing that really stood out to me about some of the institutions, including Princeton, which is the one that I eventually opted into going to, was that while I was there, luckily, at many of the places, I wasn't the only Black face in the room, and that was very relieving. Some places I was, and that was an experience in itself. But in the instances where I wasn't the only Black face in the room, that in itself was an encouragement. But then the next level of that was feeling a certain sense of safety, a certain sense of peace, whether that be through the conversations that I got to have with the students there about just the community, the environment that was created within their departments. And that could be in relation to race, that could be in relation to just some of the underlying issues that existed, or exist rather, I guess, in the larger field of academia, whether that be relationships with mentors, PIs, like is there a good dynamic? Is it a good positive environment? But then also if it felt as though the students were legitimately happy to be there, that they weren't burned out or weary for any other reason than the work that they were doing. And I think I have to explain that one a little bit, where I was very fortunate in my post-bac experiences. So as a lab manager and as an RA at Duke, that I went into a lab every day that was extremely diverse. I was one of many faces of color in that particular sphere, in that place. And we'd often travel to conferences and different workshops and be the diverse representation at that given conference and workshop. So I was very fortunate to be in an environment where I never had to question what it meant to be Black in science or to be a woman of color in science, because I saw that all around me and I got to talk to people about their experiences. The thing that I did have to sort of constantly evaluate and make sure I delivered on was my scientific contributions, my professional contributions to the lab, and making sure that every day that I was coming in, I was giving as much as I could to the science that was being done. And I don't think that that's necessarily an experience that a lot of scientists, postdocs, faculty, trainees of color, and especially Black trainees get to have, because you're sort of modulating your evaluation of yourself, not only based on your professional and academic contributions, but also your personhood in that space. And I didn't have to do that. And so I think that that's one thing that going into a grad school was very important to me, to say, is this a space where I'll be able to focus on who I am as a scientist here? Or will I also have to put the investment and the energy into thinking about who I am as a woman here, who I am as a Black person here, and constantly evaluating whether or not I belong because of that? And so I think that was a major factor in me deciding whether or not I could be in a given academic space, just saying, can I be myself here?
I think it's really important what you just said. It's a great message of, like, you didn't really look at institutions really based off of, you know, like how they looked on diversity on paper. It's you, your success, your mentality was, I am capable as I am who I am, and I'm going to make it, even if I'm the only person of color, or even if I'm the 100th person of color in that room. So that's a really important message, I think, right now, because, you know, like, it's such a, yeah. Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
So looking forward, obviously you're just about to start grad school. So this is a very big question to ask, and you don't have to be able to answer it. But what would you hope people who are, you know, senior faculty right now think about when they're designing research questions in regards to including race or not as a factor, especially I think in human research? What role do you think it should play?
Great question. I think the first question that comes to mind, or the first thought that I would hope pops into people's heads, is this science representative? Is the way that I'm approaching this question, is the way that I'm asking this question, is the way that I'm framing this question going to be generalizable and applicable to a multitude of people with varying aspects of their identities, or is it very specific to one given experience? Because unless the research in itself is meant to focus on a specific given experience, it isn't quite fair, I suppose, for lack of a better term, for the way that you approach a question to be limited as well. And I think that's much easier said than done, because thinking about subject recruitment, thinking about subject retention, thinking about population sampling, it's not easy to necessarily try and make your research question flexible and open and representative, because it always depends on who you have access to. But I think that if you approach it with a mindset of saying that that is one of my primary goals, to make this as to make my research as representative and as equitable as possible, you'll find ways to get very creative with that, and you'll find ways to make that a priority in your approach, whether that be in your subject recruitment or even just in the way that you're asking and analyzing some of your questions. I think one interesting thing that I've seen unfolding, well, two interesting things actually, that I've seen unfolding is both a reevaluation of the way that people are planning to approach research questions in the future. So kind of looking forward and saying, how can we change the way that we approach this? But also something of a realization or a eureka moment where people are realizing the ways that they have approached science previously, not necessarily being equitable. I don't know if either of you saw the paper on IQ. So the paper on IQ that was somewhat controversial and actually ended up getting retracted, where they said we didn't really evaluate the larger implications, the larger impacts of this before publishing this, and for that reason, we're taking this back. There's a lot to be unpacked in that, a lot to be said about what it could potentially mean, not only to put out or share research that has much larger implications. And I talked about that a little bit in my paper, that the way that we think about questions in our scientific sphere, academic sphere, when shared with the public, when shared with the larger community, might not necessarily be interpreted in the same objective way that we intended it to be. And so we have to think about that as well. But then even more so, thinking about the fact that the current social wave, and I don't even just want to restrict it to calling it a social wave, but the societal wave, just this cultural shift that we're currently experiencing, having influence on the way that people evaluate their quote unquote objective science, it means that science in itself isn't that objective. We bring in our biases, we bring in our prejudices, we bring in our human error, and there's a lot of different ways in which that could be reevaluated and questioned, especially in a lot of the forward-pushing trends that we have in science, whether that be machine learning and AI, whether that be, I can't even actually think of any others right now, but thinking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that will benefit from having a greater diversity of people who are in the positions to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. I, like, as being a woman in science, think a lot about including females in my research and like wanting to understand the causes of female-specific disorders, as well as, you know, whether they can be different than males and therefore need different treatments. And I think there are men who think about that, but, you know, of course, like as a woman, it feels ingrained in me that I want to ask that question.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's exactly what you said, that you wouldn't have thought about that unless you had someone who brought that perspective in. And I think that the challenging of what the scientific status quo is isn't really that much of a challenging as much as it is a broadening and a sort of reappraisal of saying, we've looked at it from this specific kind of normalized view before, but is that actually everyone's normal? Or is there a little bit more diversity, a little bit more experience sampling that could be used to broaden the way that we've looked at this?
Yeah, and to your point about IQ, I know Radiolab did a whole series called G about IQ and how biased of an idea can be. You know, it's supposed to be this test that is the intelligence quotient, or IQ, sorry, I just want to make sure to define it. I know you know. And the questions that they ask to assess someone's intelligence comes from a biased place, because you have to have had some kind of cultural experience to understand how to answer them. There's some great examples that are eluding me right now, but things like, I don't know, whatever. Like, I think there's something that was like asking about like a ruby, and someone from some country that maybe had never been exposed to a ruby before, so didn't know how to answer it. But that has something to do with their intelligence.
Yep, I was part of the discussion recently, and the biggest predictor of someone getting a good or what a better score on the IQ test is just if they went to high school in the United States. Mm-hmm. And if they completed it, right? And that is not everyone. So,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I also realized I wanted to define or talk a little bit more about the phrenology example that you gave, since it's an amazing example, especially of neuroscience being biased. Was phrenology is the study that is it like size of brain, or like the shape of your brain has something to do with how smart you are, like your behavior and your skills. And it was the people who were initiating these questions had this like biased opinion going forward of, you know, we're basically going to prove that brains from Black people are going to be somehow less than brains from white people, or sorry, skulls. And yes, I don't think that people have explicitly those hypotheses now. Like, I don't think anybody would write that in a paper. But I think going in with a hypothesis about things being different, even from the get-go, can still influence the way that you're going to interpret your results. Because if you're including that as a factor, as a factor that you think is going to differentiate two groups instead of just seeing like a covariate or something, then, you know, it's more likely that you'll find differences. And expecting Absolutely. That one is better and one is worse.
Instead of exactly, just- exactly. It's all about who is your norm? Who is your center? Who are you sort of basing your relative views and conclusions about this particular topic on?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, this is more on the lighter end, basically. What are you looking forward to in your PhD program?
Oh, I do like that question. I am looking forward to building new community. I think that is one major thing for me. And in choosing the school that I ended up going to choose, or choosing the school I ended up choosing, it's a place that I really saw an entire life for myself there, at least for the 4, 5, 6 years that I'd be doing my PhD program, maybe 7, maybe 8, hopefully not. But because I think Duke gave me so much, and there were so many things in my experience, both as an undergraduate and then as a post-bac at Duke, that I would not have been able to have anywhere else, from my academic endeavors to my creative endeavors. But I think it definitely came to a point where I was ready for that chapter to sort of be closed and for a new chapter to be opened. And so I'm just really looking forward to the community, the environment that I'm going to be in. I think it's going to be a very positive one, a challenging one for sure, but very positive in many ways. And I'm looking forward to some of the research questions, the ideas that I've only so far theorized about coming to fruition. I don't know actually if I mentioned it before, but another really awesome part of getting to do my post-bac at Duke was not only getting to explore my academic interests, but then getting to dive into the world of filmmaking. So I actually got to make a short film in my second year of my post-bac, and it was that filmmaking process that got me even further interested in naturalistic stimuli use in neuroscience. And I think now I exist at this precipice where I dream of melding my neuroscience interests with my filmmaking interests and sort of making a career out of that somehow. And so going to Princeton and getting to actually explore some of my questions about neurocinematics, about naturalistic stimuli use from the research side will be a test of whether or not that's possible. And so I'm looking forward to sort of putting myself to that test and exploring questions in that way. And also just discovering what else I'm interested in along the way. So we'll see, we'll definitely see.
It's a long journey of discovery.
Absolutely.
I love that term, neurocinematics, that's great. Actually, our next question was if there's anything you want to plug. So if you want to tell people how they maybe could find your film or
is it? Absolutely, yeah. So funnily enough, so I don't know when this episode's going to be published, but earlier today, I actually was featured on Free the Work, which is a very prominent filmmakers platform, just a fantastic organization. And they wrote a piece on sort of that precipice that I exist at, again, the neuroscience and filmmaking side and how that factored into me making my short film. And they debuted the short film on their website as well. So that article will be available hopefully for a very long time. And the short film should be available via that article for a while too. And so I encourage people to go look at that. It'll probably be linked on my website. My mom will be sharing it on every social media form possible. So you'll be able to find it. And I actually also got to recently be part of an initiative by an organization called Academics for Black Lives. And they did a 7-day training program called Academics for Black Survival and Wellness that was truly just very immersive and dived into questions such as anti-racism, intersectionality in activism, and sort of anti-Blackness within academia. And in going back to the point I was saying before of I am not a race scholar, my article on race and neuroscience should not be the only reading or kind of diving into literature that someone does about race and academia. I think that that would be a great next step to look into scholars who are not only studying this work, but actively sharing their information, their experiences about it. And so that's a great resource to look at. I got to consume a lot of it because I edited all of their videos and hopefully they look very good. So I definitely encourage people to check that out as well.
That's awesome. And we'll link to your website as well as some of the resources that you just shared in the episode.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Shadi, for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and good luck with grad school. Let us know if you ever come visit NYU. You know,
when things open back up again, I'll make sure to make the hop, skip, and jump down the road. You can tell I know nothing about geography because I just said it was down the road, but I will.
I'll be close.
Awesome. And thank you all again for having me on. I think these conversations are super important. So,
yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast and tell your friends about us. We also strongly encourage our socially active listeners to follow the hashtag Black and Neuro and hashtag Black and the Ivory to tune into the experience and follow the research of Black scientists and hear more kinds of conversations like the one you heard today. Please also follow us on Twitter at NogginNYU. That's NOGNNYU. And join us next week for a discussion with Shelley Warlow about her recent article discussing the central amygdala's role in pursuing reward and pain.